The official report on the Attica uprising tells how an inmate-instructed sociology class there became a forum for ideas about change. Then there was a series of organized protest efforts, and in July, an inmate manifesto setting forth a series of moderate demands, after which tensions at Attica had continued to mount, culminating in a day of protest over the killing of George Jackson at San Quentin, during which few inmates ate at lunch and dinner and many wore black armbands. On September 9, 1971, a series of conflicts between prisoners and guards ended with a group of inmates breaking through a gate with a defective weld and taking over one of the four prison yards, with 40 guards as hostages. Then followed 5 days in which the prisoners set up a remarkable community in the yard. A group of citizen observers, invited by the prisoners, included New York Times columnist Tom Wicker, who wrote A Time to Die. The racial harmony that prevailed among the prisoners, it was absolutely astonishing. That prison yard was the first place I have ever seen where there was no racism. One black prisoner later said, "I never thought whites could really get it on, but I can't tell you what the yard was like. I actually cried, it was so close, everyone so together." After 5 days, the state lost patience. Governor Nelson Rockefeller approved a military attack on the prison. See Cinda Firestone's stunning film, Attica. National guardsmen, prison guards, and local police went in with automatic rifles, carbines, and submachine guns in a full-scale assault on the prisoners, who had no firearms. 31 prisoners were killed. The first stories given the press by prison authorities said that 9 guards held hostage had their throats slashed by the prisoners during the attack. The official autopsies had almost immediately showed this to be false. The 9 guards died in the same hail of bullets that killed the prisoners. The effects of Attica are hard to measure. 2 months after the revolt at Attica, men at Norfolk Prison in Massachusetts began to organize. On November 8, 1971, armed guards and state troopers, in a surprise raid, moved into the cells at Norfolk, pulled out 16 men, and shipped them out. A prisoner described the scene. "Between 1 and 2 last night, I was awakened. I've been a light sleeper since Vietnam. And I looked out my window. There were troopers. And screws. Lots. Armed with sidearms and big clubs. They were going into dorms and taking people. All kinds of people. They took a friend of mine. Being pulled outside in our underwear at 1:30, in bare feet by 2 troopers and a house screw. Looking at those troops with guns and masks and clubs, and the moon shining off the helmets and the hate that you could see in their faces. Thinking that this is where these guys live, with the guns and the hate and the helmets and masks, and you're trying to wake up, flashing on Kent State and Jackson and Chicago, and Attica, most of all Attica." That same week at Concord Prison in Massachusetts, another raid. It was as if everywhere in the weeks and months after Attica, the authorities were taking preventive action to break up organizing efforts among the prisoners. Jerry Souza, a young leader of the prison reform movement at Concord, was taken away, dumped into Walpole in the middle of the night, and immediately put into 9 Block, the dreaded segregation unit. He had been there only a short time when he managed to get a report out to friends. The content of this report tells much about what was happening before and after Attica to the thinking of prisoners. "We are writing a somber report regarding the circumstances and events leading up to and surrounding the death of prisoner Joseph Chesnulovich, which occurred here an hour ago in 9 Block. Since Christmas Eve, vicious prison guards here in 9 Block have created a reign of terror directed toward us prisoners. 4 of us have been beaten, one who was prisoner Donald King. In an attempt to escape constant harassment and inhuman treatment, prisoner George Hayes ate razor blades and prisoner Fred Ahern swallowed a needle. They were both rushed to Mass General Hospital. This evening at 6 p.m., prison guards Baptist, Sainsbury, and Montiega turned a fire extinguisher containing a chemical foam on Joe, then slammed the solid steel door, sealing him in his cell, and walked away, voicing threats of, "We'll get that punk." At 9:25 p.m., Joe was found dead. Prison authorities, as well as news media, will label Little Joe's death a suicide, but the men here in Block 9 who witnessed this murder know. But are we next? What was happening was the organization of prisoners, the caring of prisoners for one another, the attempt to take the hatred and anger of individual rebellion and turn it into collective effort for change. On the outside, something new was also happening. The development of prison support groups all over the country, the building of a body of literature about prisons. There were more studies of crime and punishment, a growing movement for the abolition of prisons on the grounds that they did not prevent crime or cure it, but expanded it. Alternatives were discussed. Community houses in the short run, except for the incorrigibly violent, guaranteed minimum economic security in the long run. The prisoners were thinking about issues beyond prison, victims other than themselves and their friends. In Walpole Prison, a statement asking for American withdrawal from Vietnam was circulated. It was signed by every single prisoner, an amazing organizing feat by a handful of inmates. One Thanksgiving day there, most of the prisoners, not only in Walpole but in three other prisons, refused to eat the special holiday meal, saying they wanted to bring attention to the hungry all over the United States. Prisoners worked laboriously on lawsuits, and some victories were won in the courts. The publicity around Attica, the community of support, had its effect. Although the Attica rebels were indicted on heavy charges and faced double and triple life terms, the charges were finally dropped. But in general, the courts declared their unwillingness to enter the closed, controlled world of the prison, and so the prisoners remained as they had been so long, on their own. Even where an occasional victory came in the courts, it turned out, on close reading, to leave things not much different. In 1973, Procunier versus Martinet, the U.S. Supreme Court declared unconstitutional certain male censorship regulations at the California Department of Corrections. But when one looked closely, the decision, with all its proud language about First Amendment liberties, said, "We hold that censorship of prison mail is justified if the following criteria are met. When the censorship could be said to further an important or substantial government interest, or where it was in the substantial government interests of security, order, and rehabilitation, censorship would be allowed." In 1978, the Supreme Court ruled that the news media do not have guaranteed rights of access to jails and prisons. It ruled also that prison authorities could forbid inmates to speak to one another, assemble, or spread literature about the formation of a prisoners' union. It became clear, and prisoners seemed to know this from the start, that their condition would not be changed by law, but by protest, organization, resistance, the creation of their own culture, their own literature, the building of links with people on the outside. There were more outsiders now who knew about prisons. Tens of thousands of Americans had spent time behind bars in the civil rights and anti-war movements. They had learned about the prison system and could hardly forget their experiences. There was a basis now for breaking through the long isolation of the prisoners from the community and finding support there. In the mid-70s, this was beginning to happen. It was a time of upsurge. Women guarded in their very homes rebelled. Prisoners put out of sight and behind bars rebelled. The greatest surprise was still to come.